2 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 7. And lest I should be exalted above measure by the abundance of the revelations, a thorn in the flesh was given to me, a messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I be exalted above measure. Concerning this thing, I pleaded with the Lord 3 times that it might depart from me. And he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, most gladly, I will rather boast in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Last week, we looked at a lot of different theories as to what the thorn in the flesh was, and we discussed those. And we're about to proceed into verse 8. Before we go into verse 8, I wanted to ask and consider one final question. And that is, was this thorn in the flesh from God or from Satan? And I think perhaps the answer, in a sense, is both. As we mentioned last week, the passive voice that was used here by Paul in verse 7 suggests to many commentators that Paul viewed God as the source of this affliction. If so, Satan, though, afflicted Paul, because we see it called here a messenger of Satan, but he did so at God's direction, so that Paul would reap a spiritual benefit, which he also discusses here. This case is similar to the case of Job that we know about, but there are some differences. With Job, Satan first questioned Job's integrity. We certainly have no indication that that occurred here. It's possible that Paul is recalling an event that happened to his Old Testament namesake, King Saul, 1 Samuel 16:14. But the Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and an evil spirit from the Lord troubled him. Now, the evil spirit that troubled Saul, it says, was from the Lord. Of course, again, there's a very important difference there, though, because in that case, the Spirit of the Lord departed Saul, and then the spirit of this evil spirit came to trouble him. But perhaps Paul is seeing his trouble in a similar vein. Whoever sent the messenger of Satan to Paul, Paul knows that Jesus can remove it if he so wills, because he prays to the Lord 3 times to remove this. But Jesus does not so will. In fact, Jesus, who could cast demons out with a word, allows this one to remain. And Paul then comes to understand why that remains in his life. What is sent to torment Paul is transformed by God into a means for Paul to better proclaim the grace of God and to proclaim the gospel. And this surprising twist, I think, reflects the paradox that we see throughout Scripture, how God works to defeat Satan. You know, Satan no doubt thought at first that he had achieved a great victory at the cross. But of course, he came to know quickly that was his greatest defeat. God permits Satan to strike the Apostle Paul here. But God turns the stricken Paul into an even greater instrument of his power to proclaim his word. God is an alchemist when it comes to evil. He turns it into good. You know, we look back in Genesis with the story of Joseph, which there are many parallels between the story of Joseph and the life of Christ, and you've probably heard the lessons paralleling the two. But you know, at the end of the story of Joseph, when he's come back and he's been restored, and his father has died, and his brothers are scared. They think, oh, Joseph's going to kill us now. And what does he say? Joseph says, you thought evil against me, but God meant it unto good. God turns evil into good. And in fact, we see that at the cross, and I think we see that here, that God is turning this torment in Paul's life into something good, and he means it for something good, and it has a good outcome for the Apostle Paul. A proud, arrogant Apostle Paul would have only hindered the gospel's advance. A humiliated, frail Paul, led as captive in God's triumph, has accelerated the advance of the gospel so that its fragrance is known all around and goes up to God. It's a beautiful picture that we've looked at before of Paul being led captive in the procession. Verse 8. We just read verse 8 in the following verses. Paul's initial prayer, asking the Lord to remove the stake, or perhaps asking the Lord to remove the messenger of Satan, because that verb that's used in that verse is always used in referring to persons in the New Testament. So he may be referring to removing that messenger of Satan. But it indicates that he didn't initially appreciate the significance of what that was meant to do for him. He wanted it out. He wanted it gone. And as we indicated last time, I think Paul saw it as hindering the advance of the gospel. And that may have increased the torment that he felt from that, whatever that thorn was. He thought, this is keeping me from communicating and advancing the gospel. You know, why is this in my life? Remove this. I think that's probably what he thought. He thought it would stymie his effectiveness. And, of course, the times come in anyone's life, but particularly in the Apostle Paul, when he had to learn to accept this, what had become inescapable, and see what God was doing through him with that. And, of course, we now know that he did finally come to understand that. But, in fact, Jesus tells him what it was intended to do in his life. But he begged the Lord three times to remove it from him. Paul knows that not Satan, but God is in control. He's begging the Lord here to remove this thorn in the flesh. Satan's interest, as we suggested, would have been much better served in the end if Paul had become arrogant and proud and filled with pride. But that is not what happened. Some look here at this prayer and ask, well, did Paul pray to God the Father or did Paul pray to Jesus the Son? And there's a lot of commentary on whether you can pray to Jesus back and forth. I'm not going to get into all that. You might look at the account of Stephen in Acts chapter 7. They also look there. In the notes on the web, I have a link to a pretty lengthy article in the Christian Courier, which is an excellent website. And it addresses that very question. So if you're interested in that, I'll leave that link in the notes. The Lord's response, though, is, "My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is perfected in weakness." This response was greater and more profound than anything Paul knew to ask from the Lord. Paul does not give us the details about how he received this answer from the Lord. Did it come in another vision, perhaps? "He said to me" is in the perfect tense, which means that this answer he received still stands as he writes this. Paul learns that this stake will not hamper his calling at all. He can make do with the grace he's already received. It's sufficient. And the power of Christ will become more visible in his life as it works through this apparent weakness. The first term in the Greek word order here in Jesus' reply is sufficient. That's the first word. And that is put there for emphasis. Sufficient, Jesus says. And I think that shows his sovereignty, that what the Lord gives us is sufficient, that he has given us what is sufficient. We have what we need. And in Paul's case, it was the grace of God. That is sufficient for the Apostle Paul, as it is for us, of course. Paul could later testify to that very truth when he wrote the Philippians in 4 verse 19. "And my God will meet all your needs according to the glorious riches in Christ Jesus." Sufficient. Sufficient for all your needs. Jesus' grace is revealed in his power. Calvin comments, "God's strength is made perfect only when it shines out clearly enough to win the praise that is its due." The evidence of Christ's power in Paul's weakness demonstrated that it was not the false apostles who we've seen boasted in their prowess and their power, but it was Paul who boasted in the Lord. He was the true apostle. Barclay says, "It is the glory of the gospel that in our weakness we may find this wondrous grace." Then listen to what Barclay says here. "For always man's extremity is God's opportunity." Man's extremity is God's opportunity. And Paul had been pushed to the edge by whatever this thorn was, as we talked about it last week. And that was God's opportunity to use that thorn to better proclaim the gospel and the grace of God. You know, we learn from this message that the grace of God is not just unmerited favor that saves us, which it is. But it's a force that can sustain us through our lives as we look to and as we rely on the grace of God in our own lives. And that's what Paul was being called to do here. This is not just any power. It's the power of Christ that he's referring to here. Later he talks about it. "For to be sure he was crucified in weakness, yet he lives by God's power," we will find next week when we move into chapter 13. Paul had testified to this power all the way back in chapter 1. in Asia, you remember he was unbearably crushed, he said, but he was rescued by God's power, which raises the dead. In chapter 4 and chapter 6, he talks about the cracked clay vessel that's buffeted and battered, but it's held together by what? The extraordinary power of God. In chapter 5, we read when this earthly tent is destroyed, Paul is confident that the power of God will raise him up and give him a house not made with hands. Paul has been relying throughout this letter on the power of God. And it's the power of God, the power of Christ, that is going to sustain him through this horrible thorn in the flesh. The answer from the Lord helps Paul regard this stake, this thorn, no longer as the work of Satan, but as something through which the grace of God can be shown effectively in his life. What makes Paul seem so weak to some paradoxically allows the power of Christ to work through him even better as in his weakness, his apparent weakness. You know, in Galatians, he said, I have been crucified with Christ and I no longer live, but Christ lives in me. That was the power of Christ working in his life. You know, Paul looked like he was weak to the world and he had whatever this affliction was that we discussed last week. But it was Christ lived in him, the power of Christ working in his life. You know, while Paul is certainly defending himself here against these false apostles, what he's saying here does not just apply to Paul. It applies to us as well. In fact, the principle that the power of God rests on the humble is throughout the Bible. Isaiah 57:15, for example, for thus says the high and holy one who inhabits eternity, whose name is holy, I dwell in the high and holy place with him who has a contrite and humble spirit. Abraham confessed he is nothing but dust and ashes in Genesis 18. Moses said, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh, bring the Israelites out of Egypt? Exodus 3. Gideon asked, how can I save Israel? My clan is so weak. Judges 6. David says, do you think it's a small matter to become the king's son-in-law? I'm only a poor man and little known. 1 Samuel 18. Throughout Scripture, God has turned to those who look weak to the world, and he has demonstrated his power through that weakness. And that is God's basic way of operating in this world. Paul has talked about it in 1 Corinthians chapter 1. God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. This basic principle of God's operation undermines the whole infrastructure of Corinth's, the wisdom of Corinth and the boasting of Corinth and the pride of, it undermines all of that as Paul reminds them how God operates in the world. And it's evident in his life. And I think the contrast would be stark with those false apostles who went around acting like they were the most powerful things on earth. And I'm sure acting like they didn't need God at all to do what they were doing. Therefore, all the more gladly I will boast of my weakness, Paul says, so that Christ's power may dwell within me. With this concluding remark, Paul responds to and accepts Jesus' word. In the preceding context, Paul had talked about weakness before we got to this point. But now Jesus himself uses that word. And Paul cheerfully repeats it here. With this response, we see what Paul was like. We see the inner Paul. We see the kind of person Paul was. For in this one sentence uttered by Jesus that Paul received, that caused Paul to become joyful in his lot and in his affliction. You know, a common reaction might have been complaining. We didn't see one complaint from the Apostle Paul. A common reaction might have been bitterness. Well, okay, if I've got to live with this, then I'll live, but I'm not going to like it. I'll be bitter about it. I'm going to complain every chance I get. No, not Paul. It turned him into joyous Paul, into cheerful Paul, as soon as he was told by Jesus what this was going to let him do in proclaiming the gospel. Paul demonstrates his gladness about that as soon as he understands how it will let the power of God be shown in his life. We see what Paul was like in these verses. Why does Paul boast in his weakness? The weaker he is, the stronger the power of Christ works through him. Jesus wants to use him as a messenger, not coming from Paul's own strength, but coming from the strength and power of Christ. In fact, the wording of this last clause in this verse is unique. For Paul literally says that the power of Christ may pitch a tent over me. The picture is one of God descending from heaven and dwelling in the tabernacle among the people of Israel. We see that in Exodus 4, for example. And we see Jesus coming down from heaven and dwelling in a tent here with his people. We see that in John 1. And here we see Jesus pitching a tent over Paul. And however weak Paul may be inside that tent, seemingly to the world, Jesus has a tent pitched over the Apostle Paul. We see here Paul's total submission to Christ in this regard. It's a beautiful picture. It tells us a lot about the Apostle Paul. Verse 10. Therefore I take pleasure in infirmities and reproaches and needs and persecutions and distresses for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong. When I am weak, then I am strong, then I am powerful. This is the key to interpreting this whole section of the letter. The point here is the same point he made in chapter 4. We have this treasure in earthen vessels. The power of Christ working in Paul is most clearly seen as coming from God. And when he says, I delight in, Paul delights in this. That is, he accepts that this is Christ's power working through him in these infirmities, in these things that are happening to him. And with that as the basis, Paul can then delight in them, because the outcome is for the world to see the power of Christ working in his life. Now, this doesn't mean that he doesn't groan under this load of suffering, because he's told us that he does. This doesn't mean that he doesn't long for the mortal to be swallowed up in immortality, because he has told us that he does. But what it means is that he understands how these afflictions work in his life to demonstrate the power of God. And while they're doing that, he can delight in that. And he can say, yes, the world is now seeing Christ in me. They're seeing the power of God. They're not seeing the power of Paul. Paul would never have delighted in that. In fact, that would have been a horror to him. He wanted them to see the power of Christ. And that was most clearly visible in Paul when he was in this state that he has described. God enables him to endure it, not to escape it. And of course, we see many parallels here with Christ's suffering. And Paul is going to make those very parallels here. And he has made them before in Christ's apparent weakness at the cross. But there, his power was most demonstrated to the world in that apparent weakness. These false apostles that we've been discussing, and we need to keep them in mind because that's still the context here. They had kept the Corinthians from seeing the power of Christ. And they had kept them from seeing the power of Christ at work in the Apostle Paul. They had blinded them to that. They were leading people away from the cross of Christ. That's what those false apostles were doing. Paul's goal here, as it has been throughout both of these letters, is to let the Corinthians see things correctly. He wants them to see things as they are. He wants them to see him as he is. He wants them to see the false apostles as they are. The problem with the Corinthians is that they were not seeing things as they should, and Paul keeps bringing them back to the underlying principles and what they should be looking at. You know, we might look around us today and see the church as weak. What can we do when we're such a small speck in a world of religious confusion? What can we do when we pick up the encyclopedia of religious this and that, and let's look ourselves up, and we flip over, we're not in the index. We flip down, what do you know? We're a footnote to the disciples of Christ. You don't even rank our, we're just so weak in the world. What can we do when we're this weak? What difference can we make when we're so small? And for when I am weak, then I am strong. That is how God has always worked in this world. Always. The gospel has been cast aside by these so-called megachurches that seem so powerful in this world. It has been cast aside. It is they, not we, who are weak. But not because they are few in number, because they're not. Not because they're low in resources, because they're not. But because they are working alone. they do not have God on their side. That's why we are strong and they are weak. And when God works through us to proclaim his gospel, he is demonstrating his power through our weakness, just as he has done throughout the centuries. And in one sense, God's people have been in the majority only twice in the history of the universe. At creation and after the flood. But in another sense, God's people have always been in the majority. Because we have always had God on our side. And when that's the case, let man do what he wants. We are in the majority in that sense. Hebrews 13:6, the Lord is my helper. I will not fear what man shall do unto me. So if you look at the church today and say, we're so weak, what can we do? For when I am weak, then I am strong. Paul concludes here with a brief summary of the hardships that are listed in this letter. He delights in his weaknesses, his insults, his catastrophes, his persecutions, his pressures. The insults here, of course, are the slander of these rivals, these false apostles, the catastrophes of the hardships that he's talked all about in chapter 11, the persecutions he talked about in chapter 11, the pressures, all of these things. He delights in them because they serve to show the power of Christ working in his life. Verse 11, I am become a fool in glorying. Ye have compelled me, for I ought to have been commended of you. For in nothing am I behind the very chiefest apostles, though I be nothing. Paul admits to being a fool by adopting the boastful tactics of his competitors here. But in doing so, though, he tars his opponents with the same brush. They are fools as well, he said in chapter 11 already. But unlike Paul, they're not playing the part of a fool. They take their boasting seriously. It's the difference between driving like an idiot and driving as an idiot. They're not playing the part. The Corinthians are also made out to be fools for allowing themselves to be captivated, to be led astray by this foolish boasting. They've dishonored themselves by betraying Paul, their apostle, and failing to defend him. So there's also some foolishness to go around toward the Corinthians as well. Paul uses this failure on their part as his final justification for this fool's speech that we've been talking about since chapter 11. Since they have not defended him against these false apostles, he must defend himself, he says. The truth had to be told, more to save the Corinthians from these fools than to save Paul's reputation, but it had to be told. They were swept off their feet by these encroachers who pandered to them. They had turned away in shame from their own apostle, the apostle Paul, who first brought the gospel to them. And they had turned away from the apostle Paul, who seemed too afflicted, too weak, too tongue-tied for them. They had turned from him and had failed to defend him. We've seen money mentioned throughout this letter. We're going to see it again as we move on into this chapter. You know, Paul did not take money from the Corinthians, and these false apostles did. And I'm sure the Corinthians at first turned to them and said, well, you know, Paul didn't take money from us. And how did they respond? We know how they responded because we've seen Paul's reaction. They said, yeah, well, he didn't in the surface, but he's coming to get that Jerusalem money, right? He's going to skim some off the top. That's where he's getting his money. You know they said that because we've seen Paul's response, and he's going to come back to that in this very chapter. And the Corinthians apparently said, well, yeah, I guess that's what he's doing. They didn't rise to defend him even when that slanderous charge was cast against him. So Paul is saying, fine, I'll defend myself. And he does. He has a play on words there. With respect to nothing was I inferior to these super apostles, even though I am nothing, with the word nothing. We don't have to read the I am nothing as a charge leveled against him, although it may have been. But that's Paul's honest evaluation of his own status before God. And he said that before in 1 Corinthians, in 2 Corinthians. Paul would insist that his apostleship is second to none, though he is the least of the apostles. But he certainly does not take a back seat to these flamboyant buffoons who were running around in the city of Corinth and afflicting the church there. He knows that whatever he is does not come from others, from man, or from himself. It comes from God. If he is nothing, so are these so-called other superlative apostles. The difference is that they do not recognize that they are nothing before God. They strut around as if they were the kingpins of the kingdom, while Paul, the apostle, is cast aside by the Corinthians, as even forgetting that he is the one who first brought the gospel to them. That is what has caused Paul to launch into this final fool speech, as he refers to it here in chapter 11 and chapter 12. Verse 12. Truly the signs of an apostle were wrought among you in all patience, in signs and wonders and mighty deeds. Signs of an apostle. Possibly another slogan. We've seen so many slogans in this book. Apparently the Corinthians were fond of slogans. Possibly a slogan brandished by his rivals, or perhaps from the Corinthians itself. But it doesn't have to be a slogan, because Paul did show them signs of an apostle. He showed them all sorts of powerful signs when he was there and worked among them. But the main thing he showed them was the humble servant of God bringing the message and proclaiming the message of God. It was not all just flash and show and entertainment. It was the humble servant of God working among them. And when it comes to everything that truly commends someone as an apostle, Paul had it. From his straightforward speaking, from his morally upright behavior, from his perseverance, to his proclamation of the gospel, and yes, to signs and wonders and miracles, because he showed them those as well. You know, working wonders and miracles did not make one an apostle. In the list of gifts in 1 Corinthians 12, for example, those who work miracles are distinguished from apostles. Apostles are shown there as their main task being proclamation of the gospel. Christians must still discern the difference between false apostles and true servants of Christ. And in this case, these false apostles were apparently doing all sorts of magic tricks or doing something to rally around the Corinthians and around their cause. You know, Paul talked in 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 9, about the coming of the lawless one and how that would be in accordance with the work of Satan, displayed how? In all kinds of counterfeit miracles, signs, and wonders. So we don't know all that these false apostles were doing, but we've already been told they were doing the work of Satan. So if they were doing any kinds of so-called miracles, signs, and wonders, they were counterfeit, as Paul describes them here and later in 2 Thessalonians. But Paul trusts that the Corinthians can attest that it was the power of God at work in his life. Paul is thinking, surely they must have known it was the power of God at work in my life when I was there among them. But Paul says that the signs and the wonders and the miracles were done with great perseverance. All endurance, he says, which suggests they were done over a long period of time, and they were done in the face of all of these hardships and all of these afflictions that he was suffering. The signs and wonders that he did. Paul will take a backseat to no one when it comes to the basis for their apostleship, and he has said that elsewhere. Verse 13, rather. For what is it wherein you were inferior to other churches, except it be that I myself was not burdensome to you? Forgive me this wrong, Paul writes. I love the Apostle Paul. I'm sorry. Paul continues to press the cause with irony. He asked, in what respect were they inferior to or worse off than other churches, except he did not weigh them down with obligations, financial obligations? They are disadvantaged compared to other churches only in Paul's refusal to take advantage of them, to take money from them. And we know now why he didn't take money from them. You know, Paul was taking money from much worse, well-off congregations to work in Corinth. But why didn't he just take money from these rich Corinthians? Because every false teacher on the street took money in Corinth. That's how they supported themselves. What was Paul going to go in there and do to distinguish himself from those false teachers? I don't want any of your money. That's what he did. And that worked. And boy, is that a lesson for the church today. Do you think we ought to try to be more like the mega churches? No, just the opposite. If we're going to be at work in this world, we have to distinguish ourselves from what is false. Not embrace it. I was never a burden to you. It's in the Greek, Paul is saying, I myself was never a burden to you. He is contrasting himself again with these sponging false apostles who no doubt were exploiting Corinthians financially. If they count this a wrong or a sin, Paul mockingly begs their forgiveness here. But Paul is no peddler of the gospel. He will not be put into a position where he must fawn over his benefactors to keep the money rolling in. Not at all. That's not the Apostle Paul. He lived out the gospel principle of not seeking his own advantage, but seeking the advantage of others. And if that meant that Paul had to live in worse conditions and not have, be able to eat all the time because he wasn't taken, fine. Because that meant it would be to the benefit, the advantage of the Corinthians, as they then were able to see the difference with the Apostle Paul and how he was different from these false teachers. Verse 14, Behold, the third time I am ready to come to you, and I will not be burdensome to you, for I seek not yours, but you. For the children ought not to lay up for the parents, but the parents for the children. Paul once again broaches this touchy subject of the Corinthians' desire to support him. Apparently that was a very touchy subject at this time. We just talked about it. But they wanted to give him money. They did it for all the other teachers. Paul, why can't we give you some money? When he was there ministering among them. And this leads Paul to his impending visit. He's coming back. And he solemnly announces this with the word, Behold. He is coming again to see them. And in the closing verses of this chapter, Paul offers another explanation for his policy about refusing to accept support from them. He is their parent, and he is responsible for them, not vice versa, Paul says. The image here recalls his plea in chapter 6, verse 13. I speak as to my children, he wrote. In chapter 4, he described his relationship to them as one of a father who cares for them. And also in chapter 4, as one who begot them. So, in fact, he has earlier described his relationship with that congregation as one of a father to his children in the gospel, in the Lord. And Paul here then is appealing to the widely held expectations regarding that relationship between parents and children. He is their spiritual parent. He's given his children all they need. He's provided for them since their infancy in Christ, providing milk to solid food, 1 Corinthians 3. He has not injured them by refusing to accept their support, any more than a parent would injure the child by refusing to accept the support of the young child. He will not allow them to do what they're trying to do, which is to turn that natural parent-child relationship into an unnatural client-patron relationship. Because with every other false teacher in Corinth, it was client-patron. Client-patron. But with Paul, it was father-child. It was that relationship. And Paul does not want them to change that. And that is the difference. That's the distinction that Paul had with these false teachers. They are the ones who have injured Paul, not vice versa. They're acting like Paul has somehow injured them by refusing to let them support him. And Paul's saying, no, you're the one who had done the injuring, and you have injured me. You're guilty of failing in your duty as children to show love and honor and respect to their father in the gospel, in the Lord, as he brought them the gospel message. Verse 15, And I will very gladly spend and be spent for you, though the more abundantly I love you, the less I be loved. Paul continues the theme of a loving parent here with these expressions. I will gladly spend everything I have for you, he says, and what will be spent for you. Here's the best litmus test for the sign of an apostle. Is it some wild miracle? No. This is the test. This is the sign. A true apostle of the crucified Christ is one who's willing to spend and be spent on behalf of the congregation. He serves at great cost to himself, but at great benefit to those who he serves. The problem is the more he loves them, the more he sacrifices for them, even trying to avoid painful visits, the less they seem to love him in return and honor him and respect him. The church does not love him when it listens to and tolerates these slanderers and puts up with puts Paul in this awkward position of having to commend himself to them, his own children in the gospel, as if he were just a stranger. That's not love. And that's what they were doing to the Apostle Paul. Verse 16. But be it so, I did not burden you. Nevertheless, being crafty, I caught you with guile. The Corinthians have to agree that he never took any material support from them. And they know that. But, as we mentioned before, that has been twisted and cast back at the Apostle Paul. Twisted, and apparently some great conspiracy theory has been concocted by these false apostles. They could not deny that Paul had not taken money. So they had to come up with some, openly, but they had to come up with some conspiracy theory and say, oh, this is just a plan. That Apostle Paul, he's crafty. He's going to catch you here. He's going to profit from you. He's coming to get the money. You're collecting it now. He's going to come take it to Jerusalem. Ha, ha, ha. He's going to skim it off and you'll never know what happened to it. And we've seen that before as Paul is making plans for this collection. He's sending others. He's sending Titus. He's sending the brothers. He's sending representatives of the churches. Paul knows that this conspiracy theory has been hatched. They were claiming this collection is just a ruse. They're just, you're going to gather up all this money and he's going to skim it off the top and then you'll never be the wiser. And this is what the Corinthians were listening to about the Apostle Paul. And were they rising up to defend him? Paul would never, no. They said, well, yeah, I guess he might do that. Well, we better be careful. Can you believe it? Verses 17 and 18. Did I make a gain of you by any of them whom I sent unto you? I desired Titus, and with him I sent a brother. Did Titus make a gain of you? Walked we not in the same spirit? Walked we not in the same steps? If someone had attacked Paul's reputation with these rumors and this innuendo, he now asked him, fine, where's the evidence? Where is the evidence? Cough it up. Where's the evidence? And he's saying, everything we've done is above board. In fact, I've taken great pains to be above board in this and doing it all in the open. And this is his first question. Did I exploit you? A better translation in the Greek is, Titus didn't exploit you, did he? I didn't exploit you, did I? It's calling for a negative answer. The answer is, of course not. Of course Paul did not exploit them. Of course Titus did not. They know firsthand the character of Titus. Their godly repentance and their warm reception of Titus on his other visit that we've talked about shows they did not harbor any suspicion of Titus. You know, some have taken the references in these last chapters to be a clue as to when the letter was written. That, well, this is all still future. Possibly. But it's also possible that Paul was writing it in a sense that it's future at the time that he wrote the letter. But by the time they get the letter, this will have occurred. That these people will have come and they will have been there. These distrustful cynics among these false, they can check things out for themselves. If they've got any evidence of wrongdoing, Paul's saying, you show me. You show me where this evidence is. Verse 19. Again, think ye that we excuse ourselves unto you? We speak before God in Christ, but we do all things, dearly beloved, for your edifying. Paul's words, have you been thinking all along we've been defending ourselves to you? That may be surprising to some, because you might think, well, yeah, he has been defending himself. And most readers would think he has been defending himself. But we need to see this from a first century perspective with regard to how the courts were operated at that time. And also, Paul is not defending himself in the sense that they are his judge, because he's already told them they are not his judge. He's not going to the court of the Corinthians defending himself as if he's in some kind of a courtroom, because they are not his judge. He stands before God, before Christ. They are his judge, not the Corinthians. So he's certainly not defending himself in that sense. And although this does resemble a trial, there was in the first century, when you had a trial and you might be, you know, called in front of the court. First, in our day and age, we're used to a government prosecutor pulling a criminal into court. Not true in the first century. A citizen could pull someone in and accuse them of a crime. And if that prosecution failed, the criminal could then turn it back on the person who brought him in, and you could have a flip, a reversal of roles, so to speak. And we're seeing that here, as Paul is turning the tables on these false apostles. They hauled me into court to persecute me for some crime? Fine. I'll show that's not, I'm not guilty of that, and now I'm going to turn the tables on him. And that's what Paul has done. Verse 20. For I fear lest when I come I shall not find you such as I would, and that I shall be found unto you such as you would not, lest there be debates, envyings, wrath, strife, backbitings, whisperings, swellings, tumults. Paul expresses his fear that they've already been deceived as he was by the serpent. He's already talked about that. Now he's expressing his fear that when he comes, they're going to be riven with disputes and immorality and all sorts of sin. The first four sins here that he lists, they appear in the same order as the works of the flesh in Galatians 5. They are the fruit of paganism. And the next four that he lists, slander, gossip, arrogance, disorder, those were peculiar problems in Corinth. We've seen all of those throughout this letter. And again, he mentions those also. If anyone reading this letter, these two letters, anyone is left with a big unasked and unanswered question. Where were the leaders of this church? They may have been caught up in this rampant immorality of which Paul speaks. They may have simply been taken in by the false apostles. They may have been some of these false apostles. But most likely they were simply unable or inadequate to handle the situation there in the city of Corinth. These so-called leaders may have been the reason Paul has so much to say elsewhere about the qualifications of elders. Because whoever they were, they had totally failed in the city of Corinth. Verse 21. Unless when I come again, my God will humble me among you, and that I shall bewail many, many which have sinned already and have not repented of the uncleanness and fornication and lasciviousness which they have committed. If the congregation life there is marked by disharmony and immorality, it will be humiliating to Paul. Paul believes that the proof that Christ is speaking in him derives from his founding of that congregation and their faithfulness to Christ. And their lack of faithfulness will be more humbling to him than any thorn in the flesh if they turn their back on God after all that he has done and worked among them. Most fear being judged by other humans, not Paul. He feared God more. And he feared before God if these people turned their back and drifted away. You know, this attitude of Paul tells us why he spent so many sleepless nights burdened by anxiety over the church. Chapter 11, verse 28. Paul adds to the list of sins here that he fears that many may be guilty of doing, indulging in impurity, immorality, licentiousness. These same sins open the list of works of the flesh in Galatians 5 in a slightly different order, but they must have been rampant in this city, and certainly they had entered into the church there, as we saw in 1 Corinthians in particular, and they were still there, as Paul is afraid that he will find that rampant when he comes. And the false apostles, no doubt, were encouraging that sort of immorality to gather disciples around them. You know, in the city of Corinth, the atmosphere around them was so morally lax, and we've talked about that, and the sin that was all around them. And again, distinctiveness. That's the message. They cannot be like the city of Corinth if they want to attract people to the gospel, if they want to display Christ in that city, if they want to be a power working for God in that city. They cannot be like the world around them any more than the Apostle Paul could be like those false apostles around him. And there is a lesson for us as well today. We may be tempted to be like the mega churches on one side. No. We may be tempted to be like the world on the other. No. We have to be the distinctive church of Christ if we want to display the power of Christ in this world. And that was Paul's message here to Corinth. They had to be distinct from what surrounded them, just as Paul was distinct from what surrounded him. And next week, chapter 13. I thank you for your attention.